Tampa Bay's TAN Talk. Entertaining and informative radio for the Sunshine State.
You may be owed some money. After 911 and 411, call 541. That's 727-541-1741. Call Gulfstream Motorsports for a diminished value report. Due to my 28 years experience in the auto salvage business, I'm very good with wrecks. So if your car's been involved in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for the lost value of your repaired vehicle. And visit us at GulfstreamMotorsports.com.
Looking for car shows? Then look no further than flacarshows.com. On your computer or on your mobile device, flacarshows.com is a comprehensive list of automotive events, plus videos and news articles. Whether you're looking for car shows, cruise-ins, meetups, automotive festivals, cars and coffees, or anything else relating to an internal combustion engine, then this is a site for you. Check it out online or on your phone at flacarshows.com.
Look out there. Out there is the perfect lap. You see it?
I think so.
Most people can't.
Carroll Shelby.
Maybe.
Leag.
Suppose Henry Ford II wanted to build the greatest race car the world's ever seen to win the 24 hours of Le Mans. What's it take?
Well, it takes something money can't buy.
Money can buy speed.
What in about speed?
You need a pure racer behind the wheel of your car. That's Ken Miles.
I don't trust him an inch.
We heard he's difficult.
No, Ken's a puppy dog.
No. Whatever it is, Shell, no.
Trust me.
You're gonna build a car to beat Ferrari with a Ford.
Correct.
And how long did you tell them that you needed? 200-300 years?
90 days.
This isn't the first time Ford Motors has gone to war. We know how to do more than push paper. Go ahead, Carol. Go to war.
Thank you, sir.
Do you think you can beat Ferrari?
Fucking try.
We're lighter, we're faster. That don't work, we're nastier.
We're gonna make history.
You ready?
I was born ready, Mr. Shelby. Hit it.
Hi, this is Gary Patterson, president of Shelby American, and you're listening to Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Okay, listeners, welcome. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I'm your show host, Robert. Run your computers and Google TAN Talk, 1340.com, and you can see us, me, Bobby, live in the studios in downtown Clearwater. Don't forget to check out our website, GulfstreamMotorsports.com, where you can find out all about us. And if you missed any of our, 718 shows, check out NostalgicRadioAndCars.com. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, sports fans, race car guys, gals. Well, let's see. We just came off the Le Mans, 24-hour Le Mans race. The Ford GTD did very, very well. I'm pretty surprised about that. Actually, not surprised. Ford should have done well. In fact, that's the subject of our show tonight. We're going to be talking about racing. I played that little clip. I got to tell you, there's a lot of movies that are out there. And, you know, you always get asked, well, if there's a movie that you had to watch over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, to the point where you almost know it by heart, almost every scene, probably as good as the director and the producer, it would be Ford versus Ferrari. Now, back in the day when I was younger, it was obviously Vanishing Point. It was one of my favorite movies. Gone in 60 Seconds. Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. And a host of other shows, Cannonball, or Gumball Rally, rather. And Cannonball Run with Burt Reynolds, that was a good one. In fact, there was just an article here not too long ago on the Lamborghini Countach. And but anyway, so yeah, you can sit there, and if it's a movie, the one thing I like about this movie, now, even though I'm a Shelby guy, one of the state reps for the Shelby Club, and I know a lot of people that were involved with Shelby. I knew Carol Shelby personally. We did an interview with him. I knew Phil Remington personally. Tweedy, who used to be one of the team race car painter. Peter Brock, who I know very well, who's been on our show many, many, many times. And a bunch of other people that were former Cantwell, who was the director of the GT350 program, Chuck, and just a bunch of guys that were involved. Bernie, I think it was his last name, but he actually started out as a kid working there when they moved to the when they were still at the Venice location. And he worked on the GT350 race cars, and of course he was a hot rod. A lot of the guys that worked in Carroll Shelby shop back in the very early days were hot rodders, you know. And of course that was the you know the California scene. I grew up in Northern California, so you know I was real familiar with all that stuff. Picking up the hot rod magazines, Carcraft magazine, Car Model Science magazines, Popular Rod Mechanics magazine, Road and Track, everything. Every magazine had an article about Carroll Shelby and the Shelby Mustangs and the Shelby covers. And it was not an uncommon sight to see those cars running around on the road when I was a kid growing up in the 60s in California. And I, too, own a Shelby. I've had one since 1975. I got a 69 GT350 that I've had. Unfortunately, it's in pieces, but I got to put it back together. I did drive it around, drove it to school for a while, and then one of my lame-brained friends talked me into, hey, let's take this car apart and restore it. Yeah, right. This is in the late 70s. This was a 77, 78. Imagine that. Take it apart and restore it. I had a perfectly good. This gets into that dissertation that I went into last week, you know, talking about cars and values. If you got a good car, a nice driver, okay, you know, if you figure the cost to restore a car, let's just say at $100 an hour, and it costs on an average, it takes on an average, let's say a Mustang, 1,500 hours or 2,000 hours, let's just say but 15, okay? That's what a lot of guys are figuring, 1,400, 1,500 hours. That's $150,000. That's cost prohibitive. On a Shelby, yeah, it might make sense, you know, if you're in the car cheap. But, you know, if you got a regular Mustang and you're building a clone, no. Just fix what needs to be fixed and leave it alone. And that's the mistake that I made. So I can talk from personal experience. By the way, something else I wanted to share with you guys is a couple weeks ago I was talking about, you know, these high-impact colors, you know, like on Chrysler. Well, I said something about Mopars. And I've on AMC cars, and their colors were big bad. So it was big bad green, big bad yellow, big bad red, big bad orange. You know? So I want to make sure I set the record straight on. So it was big bad colors. You know, when we were talking about high impact, like Ford had grabber blue, grabber orange, grabber yellow, grabber, well, they never had grabber red. It was called candy apple red. But they did have grabber orange, which we always affectionately refer to as schoolboy yellow, which if you recall the factory Trans Am Boss 302 cars in 70, not 69, in 70 were grabber orange, which was nicknamed school bus yellow. I guess it does kind of look like a school bus yellow. Anyway, and I had a 70 Boss 302 that was factory grabber orange. Somebody painted it white, but, you know, if I ever had I kept the car, I probably would have put it back together grabber green because I like grabber green better, which was kind of like chartreuse. Ooh. Not as bad as the big bad green that Chrysler, AMC had. And then, you know, see, what did, I'm trying to think what the Mopar called their colors. I'll think of that and I'll correct myself and I'll bring that up next week when I talk to you guys. Anyway, what was I going to talk about? Okay, so we got an exciting show for you tonight. We got a gentleman coming on from, stick around. I always give away, but I'll say that this gentleman had an impact on this particular, on the Ford versus Ferrari movie. Okay, how about that? So if you want to find out, you got to stick around. Or if you checked it out on Facebook, you already know who our guest is going to be for the evening. But at any rate, what was I talking about? Movies. Okay, and let's see, what other movie was? Oh, obviously Bullet, you know, and which was a big one. And then, of course, the racing movies, you know, Redline 7000, Grand Prix with James Garner in it. Trying to think, who was in Redline 7000? I think that was Troy Donahue, a couple other guys. And then I'm trying to think of the one, Paul will probably, or Alan will probably text me, correct me, on the movie with Paul Newman in it. Can't remember that one. I think his wife was in that one, too. Anyway, Robert Wagner was in that movie. I'm trying to think. A couple other guys. But over the years, Elvis Presley, obviously Spin Out. Spin Out was probably my very first all-time. No. Take that back. Viva Las Vegas. Viva Las Vegas was my all-time very first, car. And it wasn't a chase movie. It was racing, car racing, stuff like that. So anyway, so where I'm going with this is that's not our theme necessarily tonight, movies, car movies, which it will be because we're going to get into that one of these days. We're going to get some producers on, maybe even producer of this particular movie. But anyway, that's what we're going to do. So in the meantime, I think what we're going to do is because we have an interesting guest coming on this evening, I think what we'll do is Bobby's going to go ahead and play some music out of the 60s, right? Do we got a 60s song? Yeah?
I think that's when it was.
I think that's when it was too. Okay, so you tune into Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Nevertheless, you'll enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, tell me, because I forgot.
Oh, already?
Yeah. My mind, hey, it's a thing.
It's 7:16, and we're going to play Polk Salad Annie.
Polk Salad Annie.
Well, Tony Joe White.
Tony Joe White, and this song was actually used in this particular movie. So you tune into Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Don't touch that dial. We will be right back.
Down there we have a plant that grows out in the woods and the fields. Looks something like a turnip green. Everybody calls it poke salad. Poke salad. Used to know a girl lived down there and she'd go out in the evenings and pick her a mess of it. Carry it home and cook it for supper. Cause that's about all they had to eat. They did all right. Down in Louisiana, where the alligators grow so mean, the little girl that I swear to the world made the alligators look tame. Poke salad Annie, poke salad Annie. Everybody said it was a shame, cause her mama was a working on a chain gang. A mean, vicious woman. She'd go down by the truck patch and pick her mess of poke salad and carry it home in a tote sack. Poke salad, Annie. The gator's got your granny. Chomp, chomp, chomp. Everybody said it was a shame, cause her mama was working on chain gang. A wretched, spiteful, straight razor tote moment. Lord, I must pick my mess up. Out of my truck patch, poke salad, Annie. The gator's got your granny. Ooh. Everybody said it was a shame, cause her mama was working on a chain gang. Suck a little poke salad to me. You know I need me a mess of it.
From England. Now, she's still a little on the rare side of cooked. Whoa.
awful.
It's worse than awful.
Yeah, it doesn't track. You know, the third gear is too high. Torque is not reaching the road. Steering's loose because the front end gets light. And over 140, thinks it's an
airplane.
Yeah. And wants to lift off and fly to Hawaii.
Anything else?
And Aeroball Trailers. Listen to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, the best automobile show in the Southeast.
Okay, we're back, and you're tuning into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and I'm going to be delighted to welcome our special guest this evening, because this gentleman had a little something to do with the movie you just heard a little clip from, and I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening the CEO of Super Performance, Lance Standard. Lance, how are you?
Hi, Robert. Well, thanks, and yourself?
So, tell us a little bit about the movie, because from what I understand in our little discussion we had down at Moto Miami, Super Performance supplied some of the cars for the movie, correct?
Yeah, it was a real, really exciting program. We supplied the GT40s and the Cobras, approximately 30-odd cars for the movie. It was a great project. Unfortunately, a bit of a sad thing, the late Rich MacDonald, the son of Dave MacDonald, who raced for Shelby in the 60s, and the movie would probably have been about him if he hadn't been killed at Indy in 1964. He was the first driver to win in a Cobra for Carroll. He was also the first driver to win in a King Cobra and a Shelby Daytona for Carroll. But as I said, unfortunately, he was killed in 64 at Indy, and so he didn't make the racing in 1966 when the GT40s raced. And, of course, Ken Miles went on to win that race, in our opinion.
Oh, there's no question. I got to tell you, the movie, in my opinion, I started to talk about this a little bit earlier, even though a lot of the stuff may not have been 100% accurate, the storyline, I thought, was very well written. And what it really depicted more than anything else, because I forgot a few things in there, but what it really depicted was the relationship between Ken Miles and Carroll Shelby. And I've always said in the past, the relationship between Ken Miles and Carroll Shelby is very much like Roger Penske and Mark Donohue, you know, if you had to draw an analogy for an American car racers. And but anyway, so tell us about how it came about that you were able to supply the cars. Tell us about some of the, and you mentioned Rich MacDonald, and I guess he unfortunately just recently passed away also, right?
Yeah, unfortunately Rich passed away, multiple month battle with cancer, and he put up one hell of a fight, I think almost 17 months, somewhere around there. And Rich was a great guy. He was actually the one that made this happen. So they approached me about a year or plus before the planning for the movie, mm-hmm. and we put a deal together, and they walked away. They actually said, no, they're going with a different company. And then that company started letting them down, and they realized, and now we were coming close to 6 months before they were going to start filming. And I'd given up on them. I was upset with these guys because they messed us around. We put all these proposals together. And then Rich MacDonald got involved, and he says, well, I'll get involved. I don't mind spending time with them and going through it and going up to Burbank and Hollywood and all over to discuss it. And he did. And next thing we looked, the whole deal came together, and they went a certain direction, and we said, okay, and then we changed the direction a little, and then they kept adding more and more cars. And before we looked, as I said, the haulers were coming there, and my showroom was getting emptied out because I was the only guy that could have, you know, 26 Cobras in inventory that they could use. Now, the Cobras were our rollers, as we call them. They minus engine and transmission at the time, most of them. And they were used for the static displays, but the GT40s were driving cars, of course, and the Shelby Daytonas that were there. We also supplied some Mustangs, and none of the Ferraris, of course. That was done by a different company.
Interesting. So on the set were you actually there during any of the filming? Did you get a chance to experience any of that?
You know, it was a busy time in business, but I did do a day up in Burbank, and it was quite an eye-opener to see what they spend just for one day's filming and what they go through. And let me tell you now, those actors are not, they are definitely spoiled. I mean, there was every kind of food you can imagine or you've read about. If you Google the food, it was available. There was every kind of snack, every kind of protein drink, every kind of drink, from vegan to vegetarian to steak lover. There was every kind of food, 3-4 times a day for everybody on set. So that's what blew me away the most, believe it or not, not the filming. But my son carried on and went to many of the other sets and across country a couple of times, because they filmed in different locations, and what he didn't do, Rich McDonald did. He also followed around. He was also an extra. He posed as his dad in the one scene, and then on the first race scene, of course, they show Ken Miles coming up behind a red Cobra and saying, "Dave, move out the way," which was Rich's father, of course.
Uh-huh.
Now, that was not correct, because that race, actually Dave McDonald won, not Ken Miles. But for the movie, they had it as Ken Miles winning.
Okay. That's right, because like you said, Dave McDonald's won the first race in an AC Cobra.
Yeah.
But I saw it was interesting because Bob Bondurant was in there, Dan Gurney. They've both been on my radio show before. I knew both those guys personally, it was real interesting to hear the names. And again, of course, I grew up in Northern California at the time in the 60s when this was all taking place, and I would read about it in the magazines and the publications. And for me, years later, to be able to even meet these people, talk to them, interview them, and so forth, it was quite a treat in itself. And
I'm also lucky to have spent time, had lunch on more than one occasion with Dan Gurney. What an interesting man. You know, told me all about his experiences racing in South Africa, racing at Kyle Army. And I raced a little in the 90s at Kyle Army. So for me to say I've been on the same track, even though the track was changed multiple times over the years. But Dan Gurney actually raced in the 60s at Kyle Army. And then you talk about Bob Bonnerant, unbelievable man. That guy could drive a car. At 80, he could drive a car. He was just incredible. His car control, and I went multiple times in all our different cars. We would take them out to his track, and we would have about 8 different Cobras, GT40s, Daytonas. And Bob was a 16-year-old. He never really got past the age of 16. If he saw a race car, it was like the first race car I'd ever seen, and he would just get excited and jump in it and just want to go around the track. And that's what he was like. He was just, and I would think it's cold tires. He's never driven this car before. And I'm with him in the car, and he's just flying down the straight. And I see the corner coming. I think, okay, this is not going to happen. There's no way this car's going around. But the guy had incredible car control and feeling. You know, they just know what's happening underneath them.
Well, you know, I've talked about this before on the radio show. There was 3 drivers in particular. I never knew Phil Hill, but 3 drivers that were well known, if you read all the articles back in the day, that were smooth, consistent, and fluid drivers, and that was Phil Hill, Dan Gurney, and Bob Bondurant. And
yep.
They weren't ramrodders. I mean, I interviewed Mario Andretti and I interviewed Parnelli Jones, and even Chuck Cantwell used to say, you know, keeping Parnelli on the track was probably the biggest thing, you know, because he was a dirt racer, road racer, circle track guy. He just did everything. And Mario was the same way. They
muscled the car.
Bondurant and Gurney and Phil Hill and I'm sure there's plenty of others that I'm leaving out, they had a certain finesse, and they were just fluid. And then one of the things we're talking about, because I have a tendency when I used to autocross and club race and stuff, I trail brake. Well, back in the day, I did it by accident and I was scared. You know, you just kind of like when you come out, you do that, right? You just tap the brakes. And Bondurant and probably Phil Hill, Gurney and Bondurant did that all the time, and they said that was just a driving technique that helped them be smooth and fluid in the turns.
And it kept the car planted. You know, they plant the car, and then there was no shock to what the car was expecting when the brakes came on. The brakes were there all the time. So, no, they were amazing, amazing drivers. Bondurant was a could be a very hard guy in the cars. And, you know, I think he was at the time about 78, maybe somewhere around there. And we were at Las Vegas, and I'd done a couple of laps in one of the Shelby Daytonas at the, on the racetrack. And I came in, and Bob said to me, let me drive this car. Let me drive the car. So I said, yeah, sure, Bob. And he got in the car, and next thing, I'm standing at the booth, and all the stewards are coming, and they're all around me, and what did you do? You were going crazy, and you went to, and they just went completely nuts. And then I realized I wasn't in the car, and I was getting into trouble for Bob Botter on the track.
Oh, wow, that's cool. All right, yeah. So give us the backstory on Lance Stander. How did you, you're from South Africa, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay,
born in Africa.
Born in Africa. Okay, so how did your whole foray into the car world begin for you?
So basically, at a very, very young age, my father was in the car business and had you know many different types of dealerships over the years. And I, from the age of 3-4 years old, my mother would drop me off, and I was babysat by all the workers that were at the showroom. And when I turned 5, I was old enough to sort of ride a motorcycle. And my dad used to put me on the motorcycle, kick it in gear, and I would just go around the dealer lot in one gear. My feet couldn't touch the ground. And that I would do for hours on end. But the motorcycle was my babysitter. And for the rest of the time, I would be at the showroom all the time. I was just totally crazy about cars. And my father was more into the sports cars and the luxury cars, and I wanted something that would be more volume. And there was a big thing going on in South Africa, which is now everywhere, of course, with stolen cars. They were stealing cars like crazy in South Africa. And the police were recovering them, and they didn't have a decent system to handle this flood of stolen vehicles that were arriving at the police stations and then to sell them afterwards. So we got involved in recovering stolen vehicles for the insurance company. So we didn't actually recover them from the thieves. After the police had recovered them, we would go collect them at the police stations, handle identification with the owners, and then bring it to a Hillbank branch somewhere in the country. And I grew from a basement in a place called Hillbrow, where Hillbank started, which my dad named it Hillbank because it was on the hill next to the bank.
Okay.
And he called it Hillbank. And I grew it to 13 branches around South Africa. And I was then the largest accident damaged and stolen recovered salvage company in South Africa.
Interesting.
But I had a bit of bad luck at 37. Unfortunately, my dad was 57 at the time, and we were out riding motorcycles, and he had a heart attack. He was on the side of the road at the time, and he had a heart attack, and we couldn't get him to the hospital in time, and he passed away. And my dad's challenge and ambition for our family was we were always going to go to America. My father loved America, spent once or twice a year he would come to America. He would buy a motorhome or buy an American motorcycle or bring something back to South Africa, and he absolutely loved the whole American dream. But my mother and my wife were not going to do that. Anyhow, when my dad passed away, you know, something changed in my mind, and I sort of I think I had a wire shorted out, and I just said I'm going. And you know, I had 350 odd employees in the company and the 13 branches, that I appointed a guy to help me run the company, and I left for America with the kids, my wife, 3 kids and 5 suitcases in 1999, December. We left December the 28th, and we actually started the American, what I call the American nightmare. It wasn't the dream. It was a really tough time, the first 15 years in America. You pay a lot for school fees. Let nobody tell you that it's easy to make it in America or get set up. It's tough. It's a challenging, and you've got to learn. And you think you're a good businessman, but you come from a little third world country to a real world country, and it was a challenge. But thank God we stuck it out. And as I said, this wasn't the plan to be involved in the replica cars and Shelby's or any of that. It was to be in salvage. But salvage in America was a $1 billion business, where salvage in South Africa was a $1 million business. And I soon realized I was going to get eaten up alive here. And we just started with a little showroom in Costa Mesa. It was my wife's idea, actually. She had been talking to the other South Africans that were selling the Super Performance Cobras at the time. It was a very small company. And I wasn't particularly interested in selling, as I said, plastic cars at the time, but I realized that they're not $10,000 cars like they were in South Africa. They were, at that time, 25 years ago, they were $50,000 already. And so we started, we were a dealer for the first 5 years. And then I bought Su Performance from the factory Hi-Tech that owned it. And I bought the worldwide distribution, tooling, intellectual property rights. And then we put together all the Shelby contracts with Shelby to build Shelby's vehicles. We were in a lawsuit with him for 4 years. But once we settled the lawsuit, we agreed to build all these cars. And we had a wonderful relationship with Carroll Shelby and Shelby Licensing. We still do. We've been licensed by Shelby now for 17, 18 years. Built over 6,500 Cobras.
There's a little piece of the story there, because we're talking about salvage there. So basically, at one point, so my listeners kind of understand, the salvage industry, when cars are crashed and the insurance company picks these vehicles up, they go to basically what they call a salvage auction. So the ones that are most familiar in the United States currently is Copart and IAA. Before that, it was Sodisco. Now, you have a Sodisco story. So why don't you go ahead and tell us the Sodisco story, too, because that fascinated me as well.
It was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me. I had bought one of my salvage pools. We call them salvage pools in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Then America actually calls them salvage pools. I bought from a gentleman who retired to America, and he had a very good friend called Marvin Little. And he kept calling me and saying, you know, Lance, one day when you plan to come to South Africa, you've got to meet Marvin Little. He's the father of the salvage pool system in America. Yeah. Anyhow, when we decided to leave, I landed in North Carolina, so I'm a real southerner, just so you know. I'm from North Carolina. One Wrightsville Beach, close to Wilmington.
Okay.
And it was a wonderful time. We had 6 months there, and we had a great time, and I was buying a salvage pool. Wilmington Salvage at the time. And I got to meet Marvin Little, and Marvin, at his height, had about 80 salvage pools. But he had got older, and the other players that got bigger and Sodisco, IAA had come in and Copart had come in and bought up a lot of Marvin's older salvage pools when he wasn't able to run them. But it was a great time with the old gentleman. He was just a wonderful man, owned a ton of property all over, but very humble guy. Would love to have made something work there. Unfortunately, he really wanted me to get involved in the company, but his daughter wasn't very keen on that idea. She was wanting to take over the company, and she saw me as a bit of a threat.
Mm.
So, and that's why we moved on, and we traveled across the country. I bought a Lincoln Navigator and a trailer, and I bought a Harley. Of course, I said, you can't be an American if you don't own a Harley.
Oh, yes.
No, they won't accept you. You won't get your green card. It's not going to happen.
There you go.
Anyhow, so we started driving across country, and we stopped in all the different states where Marvin had intros for me. We ended up in Texas, and the salvage pool that we could have possibly afforded was in Abilene, Texas. And my wife said to me, okay, you took me out of South Africa with a promise of us living close to the water, and now you want us to live in Abilene, Texas? So that was a no-no, you know. We just carried on driving, and we ended up in Rancho Cucamonga, California. And then I was working on a salvage pool there. And we came pretty close to it. But, you know, part of the school fees and part of the lesson was I found out that if you arrive in America, you're actually a nobody. And your social security number is brand new, and it has no track record. And people deal with you once you've got a track record. You've got a point level. And none of that did I have. And yet I'm trying to deal with companies and sign million-dollar contracts to handle their salvage with the slick used car sales tongue that I have. They said, Lance, we love your program. We love the idea, the way you handle salvage. We think this is a good idea. But you're a nobody. You don't exist. You know, when we run your social, there's nothing. I hadn't even had an electricity bill at that point. And that's why I knew I had to lower my expectations or my wants. And we started off with a little Cobra shop, and we're now the largest company doing this. Factory 5, a wonderful company run by Dave Smith, has sold more kit cars than we have, but we've done more call it turnkey minus cars than any other. And we also the only ones licensed by Ford, Shelby, GT40, and GM. They're my favorite little grand sport that I've wanted to do for many years.
Well, now what's interesting too is the other thing I want to bring up is since I'm one of the state reps for the Shelby Club, I will tell you that in the Shelby registry, the Superformance cars are actually recognized in the Superformance. Shelby registry. So that's a testament to what you're saying, obviously, and then the level that Carroll Shelby, you know, had his feelings towards Superformance. Because the first time I was introduced to a Superformance car. There was an independent dealer in Florida, here in Clearwater, actually in Pinellas Park, that had brought one in. And what I thought was interesting is at the time there was two or three other companies before Factory Five, actually, and I can't remember. Everett Morris was one of them, that's right.
And ERA.
And ERA, right. And when the Superformance showed up in this guy's shop, this guy had a British repair shop, and he did British cars. So he had Triumphs and Jags and Healy's and stuff like that. So the Superformance is sitting there one day, and I come walking in, and I see this Cobra kit car, because, you know, being a purist, I'm oh, okay. I looked at it, and I go, wow. I said, so what's the story? Who finished this car up? He says, no, that's the way the car came. Here's what was amazing. The car was delivered at his facility in an enclosed car trailer. It was all finished inside out, and in the engine bay was a set of headers and a drive shaft, and you had to specify what engine you wanted. So whether you wanted an FE motor or a 351 Windsor or a 289 or whatever it was, that's the way the car came equipped. For DOT purposes, they couldn't sell you a complete car. But at the time, it was $30,000, roughly, I think is what it was.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the $30,000
range. $29.95.
And with a top and the whole nine yards, totally finished inside and out, better than they did back in the day. It was truly impressive. Now, fast forward a few years later, all of a sudden, I was at one of the Shelby meets, and Carroll Shelby says, and I'm the originator, I think I can do this too. So then he came out with his cars, the original ones, which were fiberglass, and they were called component vehicles. And I was on the list to buy one. My number that I was assigned was number 77, 77, 78, 79, somewhere around there. And I received a letter that says, "Dear Mr. Malkin, congratulations on your soon-to-be purchase of your Carroll Shelby AC Cobra component vehicle." So it wasn't a continuation car, it was a component vehicle. And it was a CSX 4000 serial number. Okay, so I thought that was interesting. Now, even when I saw those cars, and they were $70,000. That was $70,000, $80,000. So it was twice what the Superformance was. So when you look at the bang for the buck, the Superformance was the bargain of bargains. It really was back in the day.
Yeah. So what year was that? Can you remember exactly?
This is the late 90s.
And late 90s,
early 2000s. Yeah. So I'm going to say... No, I take it back. It was the mid-90s, because the car that I was signed up for was in 1998. That's when I was supposed to get the... So it was somewhere between 92 and 97, 98, when the first time I saw the Superformance cars. And I was totally shocked, totally stunned, and I thought, wow, bang for the buck, that's the way to go.
Yep. So you know how this all came together for us. So while Carroll was suing us between 2001 and 2004... He did a deal with a company in Mexico to build the Cobras, and he launched a $36,000 roller against us. And he took orders. I mean, our doors closed immediately. We're selling at that point. We were at $36,000 also, and he just took a flood of orders. And of course, they couldn't build the cars. And then when we finished the lawsuit and we signed the agreement with him, we took over all those orders. But this is how good Carroll was. I mean, we charged him for each car those days was about $46,000. And he still gave it to the customers at the 36 he had promised. He lost $10,000 per car. And we built nearly 150 cars the first year for him to catch up the orders for all those cars that he launched at that time.
Wow.
And ever since then, we've built all the Cobras for Carroll.
Do you have a Carroll Shelby story for us that's real interesting, besides that one?
Well, actually, the high for me was, you know, Carroll always loved the Shelby Daytona, and of course, it's the 60th anniversary of the Daytona this year, and the winning the world championship. So the Daytona was very special to Carroll. So he said to me, "Lance, I need one of the new Daytonas." And the Superformance Daytona, designed by Peter Brock, And Peter went to the factory numerous occasions and really built the Daytona he really wanted to build in the 60s for Carroll, when Carroll said, there's no money, you've just got to put the body on a 289 Cobra. So our car is a 93-inch wheelbase. It's longer, naturally, and it's slightly wider, and it's more luxurious. It has air conditioning, power steering, electric windows, central locking, but it still has a real car feel because you've got this big V8 in the front. So it feels like a real car and drives nicely. So we built Carroll a Daytona. He insisted on the car having number 98 on it. We got the car finished, and I took it through to Gardena to show him, thinking it was just going to be pushed in the back. That was not Carroll. Carroll was all about everything in the car, the technology. We spent time talking, well, has it got this? Has it got that? Has it got that? He said, okay, now let's go for a drive. I said, okay, here are the keys. He says, no, you get in. But at the time, Carroll was about 75% blind. That's what everybody had told me. And I thought, okay, I'm going with a blind guy down the road. made no difference to him. He flew out of the gate, floored it straight away, and of course it just came. It had a 550-horse, 500-pound foot torque V8, small block V8 in a 427 stroker. It went sideways straight away. But within seconds, he grabbed the next gear, the car straightened, and then went sideways again. And he kept it there a little bit, grabbed the next gear, straightened it out, and been flying down third gear. And he said, oh, that's as fast as I go. And third gear is close to 100 miles an hour in Gardena on that side road. He spun around. We came back. But the whole time, I thought to myself, I'm going to end up in hospital. I'm going to be lying there. But at least I'll be able to say I had an accident with Carroll Shelby driving. But that was never going to happen because he was also a very, very good driver.
That's true. That is true. Interesting. Now, tell us. I want to get into the SEMA thing too in a few minutes. Basically now, if I want an AC Cobra built, all the Cobras now. We're talking Cobras and Daytonas. Yeah. You are the person. So they're no longer built in Las Vegas, and so the cars are built by you. And where are these? If I want an aluminum bodied Cobra,
You order from us. Yeah.
Where's this car built then? Where would this car be built?
Okay. So we have used in the past, we've used Kirkham to make some aluminum bodies for us.
Right.
And then we ship them to the factory and complete them. Some of them went to Shelby 10 plus years ago, and they completed some of the aluminum cars at Shelby for me at the time. But now we're doing the aluminum cars in the factory. We have an aluminum shop set up to press aluminum body cars. One thing I just want to have us straighten out here, just to make Carroll happy, because I know he's listening.
Okay.
And you're calling it an AC Cobra. He hated that terminology. He said it is not an AC Cobra. It is a Shelby Cobra.
Yes.
Now, Shelby were in a lawsuit with AC Cobra back in the 80s. They were again in a lawsuit with AC Cobra in the 90s. They were again in a lawsuit with AC Cobra in early 2000s. And we've just come out of a lawsuit with AC Cobra again.
Wow.
For the last 2 years. And this time it was Sue Performance and Shelby American, Shelby Licensing, that sued AC Cars together. We won our case, and he can no longer. He was trying to take the name Cobra away from us and Shelby away from us, saying he owns it. He has managed to hold on to AC and the word Cobra. So AC Cars may call their car Cobra until Ford, who's now getting involved in the lawsuit, because Cobra is owned by Ford.
By Ford, exactly.
Ford never jumped in and helped us. We fought AC Cars 2001 and 2002, and the case was finalized in 2023. So now Ford are having to go after AC Cars to get the Cobra name back, because at the moment it's public domain.
Okay.
In Europe. Anyhow, so just so you, we don't like to call our cars AC Cobras at all. And Shelby, if you speak to people, they'll tell you, going back to the early 2000s, if an owner with an original owner's manual for the little cars that were called ACs, the little 289s, would come, and the manual said AC on it, and Carroll would scratch out the AC and write Shelby over it.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because the early Wurman Sector cars actually said AC Cobra on them. They had a special amp light, exactly.
Yeah. The early owner's manuals all said AC Cobra. But then they were from the 60s, and at that stage there was no problem between Shelby and AC. But AC didn't play the game in later years with Carroll. And that's when it all changed.
Was that been, was, is Brian Inglis still involved with him? Is he still around?
No.
No, okay.
No, no. I don't like to use bad language on a radio station, but the person that's running the business now is just bad language. His name is bad language.
All right. All right, let's, all right. So the cars are actually, so the aluminum body cars and the composite cars are built in South Africa, correct? Not anywhere in the continental U.S.? Okay. And then they're imported here. Are they shipped across? Are they flown across? How do they get to the United States?
No, they are shipped across in containers. We bring anything from 6 to 4 at a time, depending on the orders. We ship them to the different dealers around the country. We also ship to Europe, Japan, Asia, Australia, and, of course, the U.K., a lot to U.K.
Okay. Now, I want to get into the SEMA thing because there's a lot of stuff going on about emissions, you know, people fighting, those of us in the collector car world and the aftermarket world. There was a, the issue, it was about building composite cars complete, whether they comply with DOT and all this other stuff. So why don't you, we've got about 5 minutes left. Why don't you go ahead and tell us that story and how that's progressing?
To try and shorten it up, way back, early 2000s, Neil Cummings and a couple of other guys started with a low volume manufacturer's plan. It then eventually carried through to Senator Campbell, can't remember his name, he was a California senator, and he pushed it really hard in 05, 06, and we got pretty far with it, and then it all died, and then SEMA got involved, and that carried on for year after year. We had meetings every year at SEMA, we were meeting with CARB, we were meeting with BAR, we were meeting with NHTSA. We tried everything to get this thing, and initially we asked for 1,000 cars per manufacturer, and it eventually did get signed about 3 years ago now, around the middle of COVID, early COVID, and we are approved to build 325 cars with that don't have to meet current crash standards. Airbags, but they do have to meet emission. So we still have to do emission and EVAP. The problem was we had to have them, a motor manufacturer like Ford, Chevrolet, Chrysler stand behind us and offer us a package that they certify is a emission compliant. But it's not worth it to them. 325 cars doesn't do anything for them. It definitely doesn't move the needle. So we've been in a stalemate. We tried to have Roush get involved and link to Ford and do it. That didn't work. We tried with Edelbrock, came up, and I actually supplied them a car. They supplied an engine, and they started the program. They pulled out. And then the other day, a wonderful company run by Norris, I've gone blank all of a sudden. Blueprint Engines, and it's also Marshall Engines. They in Nebraska, and they build over 2,000 plus engines a year for commercial use, and he went to Ford, and Ford has said, okay, we will supply the engines, we'll supply the packages, but you have to make them comply and do all the work. And that's where we are at the moment. They almost complete with that. We're developing the frame and the chassis of our car to accept the low-volume engine, because you have to put it in complete with the headers, the cats in the position they are, and then, of course, an EVAP for the tank.
Okay.
Excuse me. But what's happened in the meantime, of course, with all the electric vehicles, we have started developing an electric version for our LBM cars, which there'll be no real specifications. We don't have to comply with any EVAP or any smog or anything like that with those. But now the problem is to get a reliable engine, electric motor, and battery supply, and we're pretty close with all that, and then I will have an electric version of our low-volume cars. We hope to have our launch car at SEMA this year. That's the plan at this point.
Interesting. That is very interesting. By the way, is Ford going to be back at SEMA this year? Because I know Ford and General Motors, I don't believe, were there in the last couple of years, correct?
Yeah. It's the saddest thing for me because, you know, I've done approximately 24 SEMAs, and to go to SEMA and not have Ford, General Motors, or even Chrysler there is so sad. It's just not the same. But no, I don't believe they'll be there.
Oh. Okay, so now, product line that's super. We got what? A couple of minutes left, Bobby. Okay, we got about three. All right. So, what's the current product line? And if people want to buy a super performance vehicle, how do they go about doing it?
Okay. Basically, to find us, we superperformance.com, and it's SUperformance.com, not super performance. It's super performance.
So super performance.
Get that wrong. Yeah. Right. No, that's many people. I've got owners that have owned the cars for 10 years, and they do the same thing. Anyhow, SuperPerformance builds every Cobra Carol built, from the 289 slab side, as we call it, and we're launching the CSX 2000 version of the first Cobra ever built, to the FIA Cobra, to the Sebring Cobra that Dan Gurney and all those guys made famous racing. We then build the 427 in roadster configuration with undercar exhaust and side pipe. We do the Shelby Daytona, and then we go on to the GT40s. We have many versions of the GT40. It's the height of our company. It's the top dog for us. We do the little street car, which has wire wheels, the narrow hip body, to the wider body, to the wide body, and to our tool room copy, which is a tool room exact copy of 1075, the GT40 that won Le Mans 2 years in a row. So that covers. And then, of course, it took me 8 years to get a license at GM, and we build the Corvette Grand Sport. We build it to the exact specs of the original Grand Six, original five Grand Sports that raced, which is a 7/8 scale body and frame, and everything done correctly for the car, except a little more comfort with air conditioning and power steering and power brakes. But we do have a race version available, which only weighs around 2,000 pounds.
Super. That is excellent. So we got about 30 seconds left. What do you drive personally? What's in your personal collection?
So I've got everything. I love my Cobras. I've got a few Cobras. I've got the GT40, and I did a modern version of the GT of our GT40 with modern wheels and a supercharged engine over 700 horsepower and a 350-pound car. I've also got, I was lucky for Ford to select me, I have a Ford GT, but what I drive a lot is the Daytona. My wife and I, if we're doing a long trip, we love the Daytona. It's very comfortable. It's got luggage room, and I've got a Corvette Grand Sport coming for me, and I have a GT500, Ford GT500. Wonderful car, excellent touring car, and super fast, and you never thought you'd say you're going to go on a Mustang because you need a handling car. The new Ford handle incredibly well.
Wow. Well, Lance.
Oh, and I do have a Corvette.
I do have a Corvette. Okay. Well, Lance, we are up against the clock. It was truly a treat having you on the show. Thank you very much for telling us about SuperPerformance and all the stuff that you got. You got some great stories. Where are you going to be at the Pittsburgh Grand Prix? Because it's a GT40 reunion.
Yes. 60th reunion of GT40. We'll all be out there. There should be over 100 GT40s on display and probably 20, 30 of them on the track.
Super. All right. Thanks. Lance, thank you very much, and I may be up there. I'm not sure. I've got it on the radar, and hopefully I'll see you up there. In the meantime, I want to thank you very much for hanging out with us here at Nostalgic Radio and Cars.
Thank you very much, Robert. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye. Hey, I want to thank all my listeners for tuning in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Don't forget to check us out here every Tuesday between 7 and 8 p.m. on the Tantalk Radio Network for some of the most fascinating, legendary names in motorsports. Get out, drive your car, stay safe, drive carefully, and take care and love your family.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.
Listen.